the committee would come to order, please. This is a joint meeting of the House and, well, actually, it's the Senate State Affairs Committee, and we have invited the House members today. However, you can see by our attendance, we have, from the Senate side, we have Senators Davis, Huggins, and myself, Senator Terrio, and we've been joined by Representative Kapsner, who is not on House State Affairs, but she is a member of the Alaska 2020 and is here for the presentation today. Just for the information of the committee members, the bills that we have coming back for the committee review, committee substitutes, that is for Senate Bill 274, the Senator Dyson's gun surplus gun bill, Senate Bill 297, which is the permanent fund dividend checkoff for charitable giving, and House Bill 167, Representative Lynn's veterans death and memorial certificates. What we're going to do today is recess to a call of the chair, and we hope to find a time that will accommodate people's schedules tomorrow to come back together and take quick action on the CSs that are going to be reported to us. So with that, why don't we go ahead with the presentation by the Alaska 2020. We have Ken Osterkamp here, who is the Chief Executive Officer for the Alaska 2020 organization. Go ahead.
I am Ken Osterkamp, the Chief Executive Officer for Alaska 2020, and I wanted to thank Senator Terrio and the committees for having me here today. I thought what I'd do is just a very brief tour of the progress report and then answer any questions that you have, if that's okay with the committee. I think a lot of you are familiar with the process that 2020 went through to get these 49 measures. I'll briefly sum it up. In 1999, Alaska 2020 was started as a project of the Alaska Humanities Forum. It was about finding out how the public wanted to measure progress in Alaska and coming up with a set of objectives that we could track over time to see if indeed progress was being made. Also about comparing that progress perhaps to other states. So over the intervening years, we held a number of conferences. We have a process in place which I think represents clearly the best effort ever made to canvass the public in Alaska to find out clearly how we as Alaskans collectively define public objectives. We held a conference in 2001 that was attended by over 500 Alaskans, another one in 2004 with 150 Alaskans, and in the intervening time, we held about 120 public meetings all over the state, collected input via telephone and internet surveys, not only from the Alaska general population, but also special surveys of Alaska Natives. In fact, a telephone survey of 500 Alaska Native households, which I think is one of the very few of those ever done. And the output is what you hold in your hands. So this is the second annual Alaska Progress Report. We hope to make it an annual endeavor so that people always have the latest information on the state of the states in front of them, at least as far as these 49 individual measures can show them. On the contents page, you'll see that we have five major topic areas that we divide the progress report into, and those are education, economy, environment, communities, and government. I should note that Alaska is only the fourth state in the nation to complete this citizen-driven process to establish a broad quality of life measurement effort like this, the other being Maine, Minnesota, and Oregon. Two things that we've done with this report that are different from those other states is we broke education out into its own separate topic area. The other states tend to roll it up into economy or some other area. We also chose government as an area of measurement. The other states will measure things like voting turnout, but they don't have a comprehensive government section like we have in this report. And one of the reasons for that might be that they are to some degree funded by state government, which we are not. So we have we like to think the freedom to offend everybody. But I'll start out just with our very first two measures, which are outside those five topic areas. Measures one and two are demographics and disparities. Those are the primary lagging indicators for this report. Demographics impacts all other measures in the report. The quality and quantity of the population, is it old, is it young, all those questions, is it poor, is it wealthy, that is going to impact things like employment, things like health care, all the other measures. So we call that our primary leading indicator in terms of predicting some of the other performance. An example of that is if you have a large population of 18 to 24-year-old single males, your crime rate is going to go up. That's just the way it works. If you have an aged population, there's going to be a larger demand for health care if you have more seniors, which we're seeing here in Alaska. I believe we have the third largest percentage of baby boomers as a percent of the population in Alaska. I seem to recall saying recently, ICER is about to come out with the Status of Alaska Seniors report here in the next couple of weeks. That'll make all that clear. But the quality and quantity of the population impact all the other measures in the report. So if we have a primary leading indicator, what's our primary lagging indicator? Well, we chose disparities. Disparities being, we feel, a measure of how successful Alaska's society is in terms of lifting all boats on the same tide, bringing everybody along. And under disparities, there's a lot of different ways you could measure disparities. You could measure it economically, although we note that Alaska has the most equitable distribution of wealth of any population in the nation, as measured by the Gini coefficient, which is simply an academic way of measuring how concentrated the wealth is in the state. There was a report in Alaska Economic Trends 2 years ago that details, I'm sorry, 2 months ago that details exactly how that is. But we have an extremely equitable distribution of wealth. However, that's only one dimension of equity in a society. What we chose to look at here was education, because education impacts so many other areas of life. That's why it's the first topic that we address in the progress report. And if you look at education, you can see that looking at subgroups across Alaska, that the performance on the high school graduation qualification exam varies considerably, very widely between groups. That chart at the top of the second measure is the percentage of 10th graders who failed the high school graduation qualification exam in 2005. And you can see that some groups, like limited English proficiency or disabled, fail at rates over 70%, whereas if you look at Caucasians, they fail at rates somewhere more around 18 or 19%. So that shows that we're not doing an equal job in terms of educating the youth of this state, and you can predict from that fairly reliably that there's going to be social problems that arise from that later on down the road.
Excuse me.
Question?
Mr. Chair, can you just tell me what page you're looking at?
Page 2.
Thank you.
And when I refer to a measure number, the page numbers are the same. So,
okay.
So those are our primary leading and primary lagging indicators, and those are prior to the five topic sections. I'll just briefly go through. I'll pick one pseudo-random measure out of each of these topic areas and go over those briefly. Under education, on page 3, is ready to learn. That is, I think, the most important indicator that you can talk about when you're talking about education. And indeed, you'll hear in some of the other conference rooms today and at the governor's mansion the talk about ready to read, ready to learn. You can intervene at this stage in a child's education to make a huge difference with a much more limited array of resources than you can farther on down the road. If you look at the data here, you can see that looking over the past 3 years, that Alaska, and we measure incoming kindergartners, all incoming public school kindergartners, on all these variables that are in that chart every year. And you can see that, in general, they are declining, especially if you look at the reading and writing-specific ones in the middle, emergent reading, emergent writing, problem-solving, and number concepts. The performance of kids entering the school system has been going down fairly steadily over the past few years. And the most recent data for the last year is also available now, and it shows it about level. So this is of concern, obviously. This is a curve that we need to turn, and I think that if you listen to the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn folks, just to put in a pitch, I think they have a fairly comprehensive strategy for doing that. And if, I'm sorry, Representative Kapsner, you have a question?
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead. I would like today to be a good flow of information. We're not passing any legislation or anything today,
okay.
As long as we don't talk over each other a lot. So, go
ahead. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if you have this information on Ready to Learn broken down by region.
Everybody asks that. It is broken down by region, but I would say maybe half the regions, they don't report it because the numbers are too small, that there's a concern about confidentiality, although they don't attach the results of this Alaska Developmental Profile, which is the tool they use here for this measurement. They don't attach that to students' names, but still in a smaller environment, they can they want to maintain confidentiality as much as possible. Ira Perman has a chart that I developed that breaks it out by 15 different regions.
Okay.
And it's not, you would suppose that if you look perhaps at rural regions, that you might have worse performance on this, but that's not true. If you look at least as far as the data that we have shows, and it would require a deeper inquiry to really know that for sure, but I can say that tentatively, you look at the data, and Anchorage does say more poorly than Kotzebue. For example, or some of the more rural regions. And I think the reason for that, talking with Carol Como about that, is that they are hugely diverse. She calls Anchorage Alaska's largest village, which I've heard before. The diversity of the Anchorage School District is amazing. I think next year there'll be a majority-minority school district for the first time, I believe. So generalizing by region is a little more difficult than you might at first expect, although I suspect there are probably some interesting characteristics by, if you were to really break it down thoroughly across all regions.
Do you have any information about limited English proficiency being ready to read, ready to learn, that impacting it?
I don't think that they break out the Alaska developmental profile in the same categories, for example, as they do on the prior page with the high school graduation qualification exam. However, you can look to get these same categories. No Child Left Behind does require that K through 12 data be broken out that way. So you can go to the Alaska, the DEED website, Education and Early Development, and you can download test results for K through 12 and see them broken out. And you can see that there is a fairly consistent underperformance of that limited English group across all areas, if I remember the data correctly. So that's the Ready to Learn indicator, a very important one, and I'll just make one more note about that indicator, that Alaska is one of only 12 states without a state-sponsored pre-K program, and that is likely a contributor to this dynamic that we're seeing here of declining performance for kids entering the school system. Going to the next section, which is the economy. The economy has been a source of strength for Alaska for some time. We've had 18 straight years of job growth in Alaska, and when people ask me to break out these five areas by the good, the bad, and the ugly, I always say that we're doing pretty well in terms of the economy and the environment. All the indicators show that we are, broadly speaking, doing well in those areas with a few exceptions. We're doing much more poorly in terms of communities and specifically in the health area, and we're doing a mixed job in terms of government and education. Regarding the economy, let me just choose a measure here. Diversification would be probably one of the strongest ones. Diversification on page 18 shows, looking at gross state product, the total value of all the goods and services produced in the state, oil, gas, and mining is dominant. It provides 89% of state spending, as you're painfully aware. We need to do a better job diversifying the economy. Of course, the trick is, how do you do that? But we are doing our best to propagate this dynamic so people know out there exactly how dependent we are and the fact that diversification is something that you need to go out and plan for and fund and invest in. It's not something that's just going to happen as a natural course in this state. The following measure on page 19, federal spending, is kind of the flip side of that. We are really subject to a perfect storm in terms of oil prices and federal spending. If those two things were to take a significant dip combined, that would be a real blow to the state. The environment section is the hardest area to gather data for. We simply don't have a lot of good data on things like biodiversity. We did the best we could in that section, and the indicator I'd like to point folks to is the indicator on waste, which is page 27. I'm going to compare this to the state missions and measures framework because it calls out a difference between that particular framework and the Alaska 2020 framework. If you go to the state website, and Cheryl Frask is a great champion of performance measurement. She is a wonderful resource for that, and I think she's done a great job with missions and measures, but it's like turning around a supertanker. There are a lot of gaps, and this calls out one of those. If you look at waste management on the missions and measures website, their measures are the percentage of Class 1 and 2 landfills that are sited and operating correctly. However, in Alaska, we have something called a Class 3 landfill. 180 roughly out of 280 landfills in Alaska are Class 3. Alaska is the only state that has Class 3 landfills because we have such a huge population, number of communities off the road network. So having that as a missions and measure, you look at the website at the state, and you see that 96 or 98% of Class 1 and 2 landfills are operated, are sited and operating correctly. However, that is not even 50% of landfill. So we need to do a better job from the emissions and measures perspective of capturing a more holistic view of each of those individual measures. If we're looking at solid waste, we need to look at Class 3 landfills, for example. So that's what we try to do here. We try not only to have a chart about how we're doing, we have try to also to have some narrative that calls out specific sub-issues, for example, the Class 3 landfill issue.
Ken?
Yes.
On page 27, this red excerpt here, Alaskans generate 50% more waste per person than the national average. Why is that? What is that about?
You'd have to ask Roland Shanks. He's the one who generated that data. It was very difficult to come by good data about solid waste generation in Alaska. I know we have some notable successes, such as the Anchorage Landfill, which has won national awards, but we do seem to have a problem with, for example, recycling. It's not cost-effective in a lot of ways in Alaska, although there are areas that we can do it. I suspect that probably has something to do with it. But package
generating it, is it?
No, I would, and I'm really just guessing as much as you would be. I would say that we have a lot of things shipped to Alaska, and so we probably generate a lot of packaging just from that alone.
Okay.
And maybe that was more true 10 or 15 years ago than it is today. So I would take that with a grain of salt in terms of whether that's accurate today. That's something that was generated, a statistic that was generated by Roland in 2004, which means it probably dates from a few years earlier.
But recycling could factor into that, because if at the end of the process, before the stuff goes to the landfill to be buried or incinerated, if you have recyclables pulled out in huge quantities, then your stream to the landfill would be smaller. So it just depends how they measured it.
Okay. How much of this could be generated by government, like asbestos, the World War II influence? I don't know. I mean, if this on a per-year basis or over time or...
I don't know how to break out a solid waste generation in Alaska. I know you can go to the EPA's website on solid waste, and they do break it out by things like paper versus bottles, things like that. But I suspect that breaking it out on, a community-by-community basis in Alaska or by sector, public sector waste versus private sector, would be fairly difficult. Again, the environment section, it's even things like air quality and water quality, we just don't do a good job of collecting data there. And to some degree, you might think that that we have a great situation with air quality. We don't really have a lot of problems with air quality in Alaska, so there tends to be a little bit of, okay, we don't need to devote resources to measuring there. And perhaps that's a good choice because resources are limited. But you look at some things like water quality or solid waste. Solid waste is definitely a problem in rural Alaska, but we're still not doing much to collect data on that. There's a fairly active knowledge sharing group that goes out to rural Alaska to talk about best practices for managing solid waste, but they're not collecting data. They're really kind of dealing with the problem. So that allocation of resources, we really have no idea whether that's well matched with the problem or not, because we don't collect the data on the scope of the problem.
Thank you.
True in a lot of the environment sections. Crime is the first of the community measures, and I'm actually going to talk about two community measures. Crime I'm just going to mention briefly because it's such an interesting phenomenon. One of the things we do at 2020 is we try to match up public perception with the data about specific issues. So this is partly for me to cover my own behind when I'm sitting in a public forum and I say, we're doing really well in this area, and somebody stands up and says, I don't think so. I think we're doing really poorly. What do you say? It may be that we're measuring the wrong thing. And the only way we would know that is if we were surveying a lot of Alaskans and they were telling us, hey, we're doing poorly. And at that point, one of two things is going on. You're either not getting them the data that shows clearly that we are doing fairly well in that area, or you're measuring the wrong thing and you are doing poorly and you need to switch your measurement system. Now, that doesn't occur frequently, but it does occur occasionally. And one area that occurs that it seems to occur consistently in is with crime. And crime can be going down, and in fact, it has across the country for the last 10 or 15 years, but Americans' fear of crime has gone up in that same time period. And the best that sociologists and other social researchers have been able to figure is that fear of crime is an artifact of watching the evening news, where the if it bleeds, it leads mentality pushes those images out to the population, and their fear level goes up even as crime is going down. This chart of crime in Alaska shows that we pretty much track national rates of crime, with the exception of aggravated or violent crime, and that is a function almost entirely of aggravated assaults and gang-related activity in Anchorage, because the Anchorage population is so big it drives that curve. So I wouldn't think it is a definite concern looking at that uptick in violent crime, but it is a specifically targeted problem. So, and the APD, as far as I know, is aware of that and is reinvigorating some of their gang task forces to deal with it. The biggest measure in here, number 31, access to health care. I would say that health care issues as a group, as a cluster of public policy challenges, are the biggest facing Alaska. It's not rocket science for me to say that. You can talk to a lot of groups and they'll tell you the same thing. It's kind of a double-edged sword. Healthcare is also one of the biggest job engines in the state. With the aging population that we have more demand for healthcare, so we need more healthcare workers, which provide fairly good paying jobs. However, healthcare has been the number one issue cited by small business owners as an obstacle to their health, the health of their business, that is, for perhaps a decade, exceeding regulatory and tax issues combined, if you look at the National Federation of Independent Business monthly surveys of the main issue facing small business owners. So access to health care, we look at that as essentially a three-legged stool. It's based on your ability to pay for it, having a place to go to get care, and having a competent professional waiting for you when you get there. So looking at these three issues, we've decided that this is a big enough set of issues that we wanted to do something about that, to translate this information into action. So we're planning a Conference of Alaskans-style event for later this year, after the primary elections, before the general, probably in September, to get a representative group of Alaskans together in the same format that the Conference of Alaskans did, to talk about solutions to access to health care in Alaska, Alaskan-owned solutions, not affecting the national debate necessarily. To do that, we're partnering with the Alaska Healthcare Roundtable, Commonwealth North, Alaska Common Ground, and the university. We've got a good working group together, and we're designing that event to essentially feed into the campaign season so that people can talk about these areas of consensus and, just as importantly, the areas where Alaskans might lack consensus about solutions to health care issues. And we're hoping that that will help you with your job and policy, crafting policy as you move into the next session.
Can you repeat those three? The three groups you're partnering with?
We're partnering with the Alaska Healthcare Roundtable, Commonwealth North, Alaska Common Ground, and the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Alaska Health Roundtable?
Alaska Healthcare Roundtable. They're a spinoff from Commonwealth North. Commonwealth North typically does one big study a year on a single issue. They did healthcare last year, and it was a big enough issue for them. They wanted to maintain some forward momentum with what came out of that study. So they spun off this Alaska Healthcare Roundtable, and their executive director moved over to head that effort, and they hired a new ED for the for Commonwealth North proper. So, and we will, at that event, we will be inviting legislators to attend as observers based on a model that's been pioneered successfully in other states, where you get to come and watch Alaskans working through these issues. And it's a deliberative process. It's not a dialogue. It's not simply about seeing how other people view it. And it's not a debate. It's not attacking and defending specific points of view. It's a deliberation talking about the trade-offs that you have to make for any one solution to work. And that goes to the heart of this document. This is a motherhood and apple pie document. There are 49 measures in here that we'd all like to have increase to do better in all 49 measures if we could, but we can't. We have to prioritize, and we have to make trade-offs between solving public problems. And the idea of the event in September is to talk about what explicitly those trade-offs might be for different approaches to solving healthcare access problems in Alaska. Again, the legislature tie-in is that we'd like to have as many of you as possible there to watch this representative group of Alaskans working through those problems and deliberating about the pros and cons, see how they think, see where the consensus is, and just as importantly, where it's not, so that can feed into the policy cycle in the next legislative session. So the last section is everybody's favorite, government. We have a lot of different measures under government. Which one to talk about? I suppose the one that I like the best is the net assets measure. Net assets is, to some degree, kind of a green eye shades issue, an accounting-specific thing that a lot of people glaze over when you talk to them about it. But net assets, we think that this is a strong enough measure of government performance that we're trying to popularize it by breaking it out into plain English in this document. Net assets, essentially, as you're probably aware, but for the people in the room who might not be, is simply a complete all-capturing measure of state assets. So if, for example, the Alaska Science and Technology Foundation, at one point that was decided that that was not performing to where it needed to be, so it was liquidated. Well, you can look in here and see that public corporation net assets would have gone down for that year, and in fact it did in 2003, and other assets would have increased slightly across the board, although I think that, their endowment was spent perhaps that year. But the idea is that you can capture the movement of assets within government and between levels of government even with that net assets measure. So that's a really important one, and rather than trying to explain that, I encourage that people read this closely, because I think it repays that type of study. And there, I know that you're all busy, so I'll go ahead and just open it up to questions about 2020 in general, or our healthcare summit, or the progress report.
Do we have questions, members? Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look back in your education piece, you mentioned the dropout rate on page 4 in the right hand. Dropout rate is tracked by, can you call it a flat 5 or 6%? But you go on down to talk about if we did it by cohort, which I think we all understand what cohort is. You know, I guess I'm very suspect of your number of 5 or 6% because, and you, as you know, if you track it by cohort, which really tells you how many people graduated out of a set group of people, then the number may jump up to 4%.
And that's what we pull out in the narrative, is that that is not a good enough measure, that indeed having two different departments tracking, for example, the Department of Education tracks graduation rates, the Department of Labor tracks dropout rates and doesn't do it by cohort. So there's a number of problems with that indicator, and we try to pull that out in the narrative. We agree with you.
Okay. But I guess, you know, I'm looking through it. This is a good document. I'm not so sure, other than a few things, that, of, you know, the utility, I guess, when I read it. My brain is skewed. Help me out.
Well, what we like to say is that if you can't agree on the facts, you can't have a meaningful debate. And there are so many interest groups and policy groups in Alaska who are debating the appropriate allocation of public resources and coming up with facts and figures to talk about this side or that side of a general issue, that the Alaska 2020 project was designed to give you a common set of measurements to talk about public objectives. And that's what we try to do here. So if somebody says that graduation rates are fine in Alaska, we don't need to do anything about that, you can say, well, wait a minute, they're fine for some groups, but not for others. And you can clearly point to some independent data that shows that. The dropout rate would be a less clear example because we don't do a good job measuring it. But that's its own conversation that's important to have. There are some measures in here that we don't track very well. Another one, recidivism for the criminal population. The corrections facilities only have two specific missions, really, and that's to lock away for as long as possible people who are a danger to society, and for the rest of them to somehow rehabilitate them and reintroduce them to society. But we don't track recidivism in Alaska. We have no idea if half of that very important public safety measure is being met. So we try to call out areas like that, and the dropout rate is one of those. But to get back to your original point about how useful this is, I think it's very useful. I see it a lot popping up more and more in public policy debates. If you were following the Ready to Read, Ready to Learn, there was a series of three charts that they used that we had put together. This data about Ready to Learn, you can't find that data anywhere charted out. It exists in numerical format buried in some documents in the Department of Education. But we were the first ones to pull that out and show clearly, so someone can see at a glance, that we are doing poorly and more poorly over time regarding preparing kids to enter the school system. So that was valuable enough to the group that we had a specific presentation of them, and they ended up using that data and those charts in their effort to get the state to adopt a pre-K program. So we think that it has quite a bit of utility in terms of informing the debate.
Senator Davis.
Yes. This is what number report?
This is the second report. The first one was 2004.
I don't recall that 2004. Could I get a copy of that?
You could. It's the exact same report with older data. But if you want a copy, I'd be happy to send you one.
Well, and actually, let's see. There's so many of these, though, that are, you said 2000, like I'm looking at post-secondary education. The last bar graph you have here is 2002. Some of them, though, are 2004.
Education.
Well, I was thinking that, all of that data is contained here, but not necessarily.
We do try to just extend the data series year to year. It's not that anything in here necessarily changes every year enough to warrant a completely new report, but we don't change that much, so our effort to put it out every year becomes relatively less and less, and we think it's important for people who are having debates around these topics, and who knows who's going to have what debate when or where. We want them to have the most recent information, and we do tweak it a little bit every year to make it better and more understandable. It's a communications effort more than anything. We don't generate any new data. We come up with new ways of displaying it, and we relate it to a process that, as I mentioned, is the best process in place to show what the public thinks the objectives we should be working towards are. So that's the value add, if you will, of our organization.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Kapsner.
I just wanted to mention that we don't have a long history in Alaska of having information gathered like this. And I know in the Native community, when first Alaskans came around, they weren't really sure what form they would be taking, and it, after a year or two, they decided the best purpose they could serve is one exactly like this, is to gather information and be a research entity so that when public policy issues do come up, that there are hard numbers and data and graphs and things like that to present to policymakers. Do you work with First Alaskans?
We do. Greta Goto and I communicate fairly frequently. In fact, they have just hired an individual whose name escapes me at the moment with a grant from the Denali Commission to develop performance measures for rural economic development. And so we'll be working, I think, with them to help them get up to speed. One of the things I would note about that idea that data is becoming more and more important. We are becoming every year a more and more data-rich society, and that data is being used to make decisions about public programs. And in fact, there was an article in the Anchorage Daily News just a few days ago about, I think it was the Village Safe Water Initiative being deemed ineffective and being cut by the administration in Washington because of that measurement. That was a result of performance measures that somebody put in place, went out, got the data, and presented them, and they said, hey, this isn't working, we're cutting it. Now, if that was all done correctly, that's great. That's an example of a program that was truly ineffective being cut. But was it? We don't know, because nobody really knows what the performance measures are. What we're trying to do with these measures is give a focus to whether we are making a difference, organizations are making a difference in their mission. An example of that is the Denali Commission. We're working with them right now to use some of these measures to adapt them to rural Alaska so that when they are rated by the federal government, as all federal agencies are under JIPRA, when they are rated, they can point to an independent set of measures that either match or don't match theirs. That strengthens their reporting requirements. In fact, they're encouraged to do that under JIPRA by the Government Accountability Office. So we have some value to add there to other organizations, and in fact we're working with a wide range of partners to drive a common framework for measuring the difference that all these organizations are trying to make in public policy terms in Alaska.
Senator Huggins.
Okay, and you said this was your second iteration?
Correct.
Yeah. When you contrast iteration one and iteration two, what sort of satisfaction points do you have as far as product improvement?
Well, the data has definitely gotten better in terms of simply eliminating some of the confusing language and titles and things in there. We've changed some graphs. We've improved it based on the input that we get. We did not get as much input as we wanted when we first created the report, but it was one of those cases of running up the flagpole and see who salutes. Once we had it out, we started getting plenty of plenty of input. So we're improving it every year, and that's another reason to make it an annual document, is so that we can improve it to make it more responsive to what Alaskans want to measure. It is a dynamic document at heart, and it needs to change, and it will year to year because we're a citizen-driven organization.
So if you look at year one, year two, and I'm sure you're now looking at year three as far as the process, what do you see your modification and product improvement for the coming year?
In terms of actually producing the report?
Yeah. And what you're focusing on that the dynamics involved that are causing you to evolve in your ability to not necessarily have a thicker document, but have one that might be more user-friendly or might be more specific or whatever the quantitative things that you have.
That's a great point that you raise. Ideally, you'd have a thinner document, but the work, it's so much more work sometimes to reduce a large, complicated set of issues than it is to expand and write a dissertation on it, that's really the challenge. And getting it down to one page per measure was a huge deal for us. What we're doing to improve that over the next year primarily revolves around the delivery of the information more than it revolves around any specific modifications to the information itself. We're trying to get all of these measures into our website so that you can call up the latest data and actually download it if you want from our website. But since we only have a single full-time staff member, and that's myself, that's going to take some doing. But we have started discussions with the Department of Health and with the United Way of Anchorage and a couple other organizations to partner on a data warehouse, essentially, so that people can start looking at these common measures and getting the data that they need without having to reinvent the wheel every time. So that's one of our major process improvements that we're working towards, is getting that website to be more valuable to people and to make that information more widely available across the internet. I would note that on our website, we do change our website, our homepage, every month, and we send it out as an electronic newsletter, and we list a lot of different public policy-related research and events on the site. And we got, last year, about 15,000 hits on our website, which for a one-person organization with a board of nine and being fairly recent one at that, and dealing with kind of a wonkish subject matter, is pretty darn good. There's a definite draw out there for the information that we're putting out. And the internet has been a big lever for us in getting that out.
You mentioned the board of nine.
Looking for that.
They are listed on, I believe it's page, on the introductory page, page one of the preface. We started out with a board of 25 back in 2002, and we just recently approved essentially lowering the minimum number of board members to nine, although we currently have 10 or 11 board members. We were much more concerned about having statewide input when we were developing the objectives. Now it's more of a maintenance effort, so the board felt it was appropriate to lower the minimum number of board members to nine.
We got two of the celebrating ones with us, I see.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We have a very good, broad constituency in our board.
Excuse me, Clark.
We almost have a quorum.
Hey, I take back everything I said. Put this under my pillow.
Let the record show. We do have an unusual representation on our board in that we'll have a meeting where we have someone from the coal industry, Bob Stiles, sitting across the table from someone from the Alaska Conservation Foundation, Julie Jessen, and it's a real treat to have that perspective on a board when they're taking a real logical, public, objective-minded approach to discussing these issues.
Another question. Mary, did you have another question? Okay, I didn't check with my staff to see how many copies did you send down to us.
A box of 120 copies.
Okay, so I think what we'll do is, on the Senate side, can certainly make sure that everybody has one in their box tomorrow, perhaps under special orders. I'll just highlight it for the members so that they know that it's in, you know, the volume of stuff that we get on a daily basis. So if you want to do the same thing on the House side, then.
I do have one more note. You asked about improvements. I should mention this because it's going to be more interesting to you as a result of this action that we're taking. We are working to make these measures more granular so you can look and compare regions and perhaps communities within Alaska on these same measures. And I think that would make it a lot more useful. It's a much bigger job, but that is something that we are interested in doing because nobody lives at the statewide level. people live in communities, and that's where the action is taken to turn the curve on these measures. So that's one of the things that we're working on with that Department of Health and United Way partnership that I discussed.
Any other questions? If not, then at this time, we'll recess to the call of the chair today. And again, for the Senate members, we have the three CSs that are being developed. Because of our press for time today with resources going on next door, we'll try and coordinate everybody's schedule so we can have a quick meeting. We're not trying to slip anything through. They're fairly non-controversial. We're just trying to hammer out the last language with the drafters before we take final action. So with that, we will recess to the call of the chair and hopefully get something set up tomorrow to take action on the CSs.